And you can see why. It's a death which has one instigator, Herodias, just like in the Gospels you show, you know, the religious authorities, the Sanhedrin and so forth, who are plotting the death of Jesus, but they had never been able to bring it about before. And what is specific about that death? It's the crowd. It's the crowd that gets together suddenly, you don't know why. 3 days before, they had received Jesus as a hero. And the guest at the banquet of Herod had no reason to be against John the Baptist. But suddenly they all get together. And they ask for the head of the victim. A victim they have no particular reason to hate, which is what the Gospel says. They hated me without a reason. But it doesn't happen to Jesus only. It happens to John the Baptist too. Why does it happen to John the Baptist? This is the strangest thing. You know, and Luke was probably a little bit scandalized by that. Since we have the death of John the Baptist in two of the Synoptic Gospels, but we don't have it in the third one. You know, Luke says, enough about Herod, now let's concentrate. Let's focus on Jesus. Why does John the Baptist die this death? Which is the instrument that gets the people to ask for the head of John the Baptist? It's Salome. Her name is not even in the Gospel. But it's a dancing of Salome. You know, many people feel it's a little bit scandalous to have that scene in the Gospels. And what does that dancing do? You know, if you look at dancing in the Greek world, which is what tells us most, it tells us dancing is the most mimetic of all arts. And it's always, you always encounter it in sacrifice. Dancing is what gets the participants together against the victim. It unites them against the victim for no good reason, of course, for a reason of spirit of togetherness, the madness of the crowd, feeling good about oneself being part of the crowd, like Peter does when he denies Jesus. This inability we have to stand alone and that necessity in which we always find ourselves to follow the crowd is responsible for the death of Jesus, but also of John the Baptist, of the suffering servant, and so on, and probably of all the victims behind all religions in the world. Therefore, if you follow this text, you can see that it is also an interpretation of myth. Men have religions because they cannot stand alone. They get together against victims. You know? And somehow, if they are really united with each other, they end up reconciled by their victim, feeling better. Even after the Passion, people feel better. And Luke, who tells us all sorts of interesting things, takes the time to tell us something which is unrelated to the resurrection, but which is an effect of the death of Jesus, which is immediate. He tells us, from that day on, Herod and Pilate, who were enemies, became friends again. This is a direct effect of the death of Jesus. Is it a Christian effect? Doesn't look too Christian to me. It even looks pretty satanic to me, this reconciliation against Jesus. You know. So what is going on there? What is that type of death, you know, which we have in the Passion, in all the prophets, and unquestionably, according to the Gospel, Satan was a murderer from the beginning, meaning he was a murderer from the beginning, but he kept being a murderer. He became specialized in this type of murder, you know. Satan is the founder of human culture. That's what it means. Human culture is the work of Satan. There is a lot of disorder created by Satan. And then Satan expels himself. That's pretty weird. That's why Jesus asked the question. It's one of the most important questions about culture in the Synoptic Gospels. And I guess it's in all three. How can Satan expel Satan? This question is not there to make you doubt that Satan expels Satan, but to show you the paradox of the force of disorder in human affairs being also, ultimately, the force for order. When people become so mad at each other, so beset, you know, by rivalries and everything, that total disorder shows up, you know, ultimately they'll gang up against the victim and become reconciled against that victim. They'll find what we call today, in our language, a scapegoat. So, you see, the Gospels are even closer to myth than we thought before. We're really at the bottom of the pit. Because what I'm saying here is all pagan religions, ultimately, are divinized scapegoats, the gods. Why divinized? If you have a problem, you know, such as the crisis I'm talking about, and finally you become united against the victim, you project all your problems on that victim. This is transference of a much more efficient kind than anything the psychoanalysts have ever talked about. To find the right scapegoat at the right time. This is 2/3 of political wisdom anyway. Maybe 9/10. Unless you find the right scapegoat, you know, you won't have. Like today, we don't have the right scapegoats. We have too many of. Not at all, and that's why we are in such a mess. You see what I mean? But if you find the right scapegoat, ultimately your problems will be solved. Well, in the ancient world, this system worked, but it worked much better because it was religious. What does it mean that it was religious? It meant that if you had suffered enough from some crisis, and suddenly the scapegoat solved your problem, these people were much more modest than we are and much more humble. And they said to themselves, how could we be the authors of our reconciliation? We tried many times and we couldn't do it. Who could it be? And the only individual they can turn to is their scapegoat. He destroyed us first, or he warned us that we were bad, and then he saved us by dying. Therefore, A, religion is a divinized scapegoat. He is all-powerful for evil first, he disrupts the community, and then he is powerful for good. Take the Oedipus myth that we all know. He committed parricide and incest, he caused the plague, you expel him, and you have no more plague. Therefore, he ends up as a minor divinity of what? Marriage. That's typical myth. The villain who transgresses the law and is punished for it ends up as the god that sets up the law, even though it doesn't fit logically. But that's the way a myth is. You have a transgressor, he's punished by the whole community, and he becomes the god. Look at Dionysus, look at... This is typical. So, if you see this, you look at Christianity, and you say, Jesus is a scapegoat, obviously, more visibly than anybody else. You can see it because it's described in an extremely graphic and, realistic way. And ultimately he ends up as God. But is it the same thing? To a scholar, it is the same thing. How could it be different? Completely different, because the scapegoat is divinized insofar as he is guilty and therefore has been punished rightly. Whereas Jesus, you know, the whole crowd is ready to behave towards him exactly like in a myth. They think he's guilty. But the Christians are not the people who accept this universal view. They are the few dissidents who say he is innocent. Therefore, if he is innocent, how could he be divinized as a scapegoat? He's divinized, but not as a scapegoat. And I will say he is divinized because he reveals the whole system of ganging up against the victim which is the system of religion. In other words, in my view, Christianity is the inversion and the revelation of all other religions. If we are able to speak about scapegoats, if we are able to condemn the people who persecute victims unjustly, it is because of Christianity. We do not realize how unusual that is. We live in a society which is able to say that a man who is condemned by everybody, universally regarded as guilty, nevertheless can be innocent. We have a feeling this is perfectly normal to think that. That the whole community could be wrong about a victim. We don't realize that it's a purely biblical and Christian affair that has never existed in any other world. We live in a world where we see that victims can be victimized wrongly, even if they are by the whole community. As a matter of fact, today it's become our principal business, which is very often abused. But we don't realize this is an exclusively Judaic and Christian phenomenon. And in my view, the reason for this, it's because Judaism first, to a certain extent, and Christianity more radically, reveals the scapegoat system of culture. Reveals that culture is entirely based on gods that in fact are arbitrary victims that have been destroyed by the whole community. Like Jesus. But Jesus is presented as such. And in the Gospels, we don't talk about scapegoats, because scapegoat means guilty. But there is a word, an expression that replaces scapegoat much better, and that we should use every time we say a victim has been condemned unjustly. But we don't use it, because it would remind us of Christianity. And it is the Lamb of God. The scapegoat is that goat which was covered with the sins of Israel by the high priest laying his hands on it. And in a way, everybody believed it. And the scapegoat was driven into the desert, and we never heard. In Christianity, the scapegoat is replaced by the Lamb of God. In other words, the victim is innocent. In other words, the God is no longer the God of violence and evil, but exclusively a good God. Because all primitive God, and even in part the God of the Old Testament, are gods of violence and peace. They are gods of peace because they are gods of violence. They are gods of violence because they are gods of peace. There is always an endless exchange between these two things. Only in Christianity proper there is no such aspect. And God is the Lamb of God, the victim unjustly condemned. So in my view, the revelation, in a way, in order to reveal the scapegoat system of culture, Christianity goes through the same sequence of events. But the founders of Christianity are not this total community, you know, that lives in the delusion that its victim was guilty, then saved them as a culprit, like Oedipus. Therefore is that God of violence and peace. But that the victim is totally innocent and reveals the injustice of human culture. A much more difficult world, a world which has a relationship to culture entirely different from that of other religions. And that at the same time, a God that can be most easily confused with all these other gods. And if you look at the great biblical stories, you will see that they are all critiques of mythology. In order to make myself clear, I will take an example. I will take the Joseph story. The Joseph story is way back in Genesis. It's at the end of Genesis, but we know it's a very old story. You know, and if you look at the Joseph story, you will see that in some respects, it is the same story as the Oedipus myth. We have a child, and he's accused of being a danger to his family. Oedipus is accused by an oracle, which announces that he will kill his father and so forth. And Joseph has these dreams, you know, that make him the future ruler of his 12 brothers. And they are pretty mad at him. As a result, in the Oedipus myth, the parents get rid of the child. They think they are going to destroy him forever, but in fact he ends up in another city, in Corinth. In the Joseph story, Joseph is sold into slavery or discarded or something. There is a place in the text which is a little confusing and mixed up. But anyway, he ends up, like Oedipus, in another city in Egypt, you know, and abandoned by his family. In the second part of these stories, the outcast son, becomes a very important fellow. Oedipus becomes the king of Thebes, and Joseph first becomes the intendant of Potiphar, you know, who gives him all power over his possessions. And in both stories, you have an accusation against this hero, this character. And it's an accusation of the same type, because Oedipus is accused of becoming the husband of his mother. You know, he's accused of one of his sexual crimes, which you find all over the place in mythology, and of killing his father on top of a bargain. And Joseph is accused of making love to the wife of his quasi-father, Potiphar, by Lady Potiphar. And then in the third part of the story, you have the same thing once again, because, the hero is connected with a great social scourge, the Theban plague, in the case of the Oedipus myth, the great drought of Egypt, in the case of Joseph. But in my view, the real question in both texts is the hero guilty? Is he guilty of being a threat to his parents? Is he guilty of having slept with whomever it is he shouldn't sleep with? Is he guilty of being responsible for the social scourge? And in the Oedipus myth, the question is yes. He's guilty of, he's a danger to his parents. Yes. He slept with his mother. Yes, he's responsible for the Theban plague. Therefore, he should be expelled. He's guilty, 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 guilty on all counts. In the Joseph story, the question to all these questions, the answer is no. No, it's his brothers who are jealous, who are telling all sorts of stories, are dipping his tunic into the blood of a goat to make the father believe, you know. No, he has not slept with Lady Potiphar. It's Lady Potiphar who tried to seduce him, and he resisted gloriously. No, he's not responsible for the drought. On the contrary, he's the inventor of modern storage business, economy, and the stock market and everything. And he saved the Egyptians instead of destroying the Thebans. Therefore, he should be exalted and praised. It's the Gentiles who believe that nonsense, not the Jews.